Good morning, almost afternoon, everybody. The British are coming, the British are coming, were the famous words of Paul Revere on the 18th of April, 1775, when he made his midnight ride, known to every American schoolchild, to warn that the British were coming on the evening, the night just before the battles of Lexington and Concord, which began the American War of Independence. As he rode around on his horse around Massachusetts, warning that the British were coming, I was reminded of that after the night of the 23rd of June 2016, when as shockwaves were felt right across Europe, right across the world, the shockwaves in the days and weeks afterwards are particularly felt in commercial law firms in Dublin, because Dublin was awash with rumours that big London-based international law firms, because London, as we know, is one of the great, with New York, with the two great legal centres of legal practice worldwide, that those firms were coming to Dublin. They were going to maintain their foothold in the European Union by establishing here, by there were rumours of office blocks were being built or where space was being acquired. Entire law firms, named law firms in this city, were being acquired by named law firms in London. All this was going to have a traumatic effect on international legal practice by here in Dublin. It really would not have been, as I remarked at the time, any surprise to have seen a horseman riding up and down the banks of the Liffey shouting, "The British are coming." The reality, however, has been more mundane. And I have, and I'm going to show in a moment, the actual statistics of what's happened in relation to international legal practice and what has been happening in terms of arrivals in Dublin. And I'm going to ask maybe just for the moment that my good friend Gavin there might put up the first slide, which I'm going to use. This is correct as of 23rd of October, just a few weeks ago. The numbers change every day. England and Wales solicitors arrived on the roll in Ireland 1,917 since the 1st of January 2016, because the Brexit phenomenon began before actually the 23rd of June. And I remember doing an interview in Sean O'Rourke actually before the Brexit vote, talking about this phenomenon. We were beginning to see England and Wales solicitors appear on the roll of solicitors in Ireland. And the total number is pretty well up to date there, as you can see, about 2,011 in total. The total number of solicitors on the roll in this jurisdiction, and these are figures that we have in the Law Society, obviously we maintain the roll of solicitors, we'll continue to do so. Total number of solicitors on the roll at that date was 18,409. And to save you the math, as the Americans would call it, I will tell you that 11% of the solicitors on the roll in this jurisdiction are England and Wales, primarily England and Wales qualified solicitors. How is that operating? Well, first of all, the mechanism by which they did so, and I'm around in the Law Society long enough, even before I was Director General, I was a member of the Education Committee of the Law Society, and in fact, it was during a period where I was based and lived and practiced in Brussels from 88 to 92, I set up and ran the A&L Goodbody office in Brussels. And I remember that, and if you look at the actual date of the directive in question, known as the Mutual Recognition of Diplomas Directive in its shorthand, it was actually adopted by the Commission on the 21st of December 1988, which I recall was the last, I think it was adopted by the Commission. There was a whole thing, so it went before the Commission, final adoption at that date, which was the very last day of the Commission sitting in which Peter Sutherland was the European Commissioner at the time. And I know from other people, he was very keen that a lot of things went through, one of which was the McGill case actually was decided by the Commission on that date. But in any case, under the 1989, it was the directive published in 1989, known as the qualified lawyer. The Law Society then and all of the member states would make regulations to implement, and the Law Society did under its statutory power, created the statutory instrument number 85 of 1991. The directive is the Council of the European Community for the Recognition of Higher Education Diplomas, dated 21st December 1988. And it is encouraged in a very communautaire way, the recognition of legal qualifications across member states. Most member states had and have the capacity to create a system of examinations, often referred to as qualified lawyer transfer, tests, requirements of knowledge of law in the jurisdiction to which the lawyer wished to transfer. And we have in our regulations, the Law Society regulations, the potential for examinations in constitutional law, criminal law, company law, law of contract and tort, conveyancing, taxation law, solicitor's accounts. All of these are potential examinations that can be taken by lawyers transferring. However, it says here, unless the society otherwise determines, however, either generally or in an individual case, an applicant who has been admitted to the role of solicitors in A, Northern Ireland, or B, England and Wales, shall not be required to pass any part of the test. So effectively, in shorthand terms, it's a mutual recognition regime. There is an administrative process which has to be undertaken to fill out the paperwork and to go on the roll. If you're an England or Wales solicitor, to come on the roll in Ireland, or an Ireland solicitor. I'm on the roll in England or Wales. I'm sure maybe other people here maybe as well. And we at the time envisaged this to be that Ireland was always traditionally had been a net exporter of solicitors. And at times, particularly at hard economic times in this jurisdiction, it was a safety valve for the surplus of solicitors who are being qualified here that would go to this enormous jurisdiction next door. I sometimes say we're like a rowing boat sitting beside a super tanker, you know, in terms of the jurisdiction is about 12 times the population and size in terms of England and Wales of this jurisdiction. And many, many Irish solicitors, hundreds and hundreds of Irish solicitors have followed that path, had careers, many of them largely in big City of London law firms and had very successful careers there. Never really expected, nobody ever expected, that the traffic would be east to west across the Irish Sea instead of west to east across the Irish Sea. But we have fought hard to maintain that because it helps to maintain a degree of parity. Frankly, Solicitor of England and Wales is a global brand. Solicitor of Ireland is not really a global brand. We might like to pretend it is, but it really isn't. But the equivalence that is created by the mutual recognition, the capacity to transfer onto the role in England and Wales is very powerful internationally because among the largest law firms in the world are England and Wales headquartered law firms. So again, in terms of further detail of what has actually happened in practice, I'm going to ask Gavin here to put up my second slide. These are more or less up-to-date figures, naming the major international law firms with solicitors on the roll in Ireland. Evershed, Sutherland, as you can see, are just right up there at the top, 132. Freshfields, Brookhouse, 131. Slaughter & Ray, Allen & Overy. Latham & Watkins, Linklaters, and you can see all the names down there. That's just the top 20. Clearly, there are many below that in numbers as well. Evershed Sutherland, of course, is effectively an Irish firm, or there is an Irish firm or branch of Evershed Sutherland that was formerly O'Donnell Sweeney & Co. became Evershed Sutherland and practicing in Elsford Terrace very successfully under that name. But they happen to have the largest number, but those numbers change on a daily basis. Freshfields, Brookhouse, Deringer are, if you Google largest law firms in the world, you'll see the Freshfields are ranked currently about seventh biggest law firm in the world. And my then president of the Law Society and I went over to meet with Freshfields when we saw this phenomenon emerging in 2016. And we were very, met on the top floor of their office there in Fleet Street. And met with the senior partner and the global managing partner and international. This is a law firm that's so big it has its own in-house law firm, which advises Freshfields on regulatory compliance. We met with what I call the top brass of Freshfields, very, very welcoming. They pay tribute to the efficiency with which all of this was being run by the Law Society of Ireland. We were told it was a bit more efficient than they would have expected from the English equivalent. Anyway, they were very nice about it. And of course, then at the very end of the meeting, we gently rolled across the table the question. We're just wondering, kind of, you any plans to set up in Dublin? And Edward Braham, who is the senior partner, and he was the main man because it's quite clear he sat at the top of the table. The global managing partner sat next to him. But I agreed with him, and he doesn't mind me quoting his name because I have his agreement. We exchanged emails afterwards, what I could say. He was quite prepared to say on the record that Freshfields have no plans to establish an office in Dublin. We did, and I've spoken to senior figures in many of these firms, because naturally we make it our business to find out what's driving this and what's motivating it. And they talk pretty openly about it, actually. And Freshfields said this, and others have said this as well. They're concerned about two things. It is the EU and competition law practitioners primarily that are transferring. It's not the M&A guys, it's not the litigation solicitors, the EU competition law practitioners, whether based in their London offices or their Brussels offices. And they are transferring here, and they have two particular concerns, which relate to their status post-Brexit. And the concerns are relate to rights of audience in CJEU, rights of audience in the court in Luxembourg. Not that many of them actually exercise it, but it's a status issue. And the second one they talk quite openly about is legal privilege in EU, primarily EU competition law matters. So I'll talk a little bit about further about that at the moment. Well, let me just talk first about rights of audience. Article 19 of the CJEU, the statute of CJEU, states, only a lawyer authorised to practice before a court of a member state or of another state which is party to the agreement, EEA, may represent or assist a party before the court. Nationality is not a criterion here. This is by way of commentary, so it doesn't matter if the lawyer is an EU and EEA citizen in order to have the right of audience. The lawyer must only have the authority to practice before the court of one of the member states. I say the nationality issue is in contrast to other EU rights of practice, which require EU citizenship because they're part of the four freedoms. And the other one then is legal privilege. And privilege, as you know, doesn't exist in any statute of the EU. It is effectively judge-made law. The famous AM&S case, which was reported in the Court of Justice in 1982. And just by way of aside, I remember chatting to, when I arrived in Brussels first, the doyen of the Irish lawyers in Brussels was John Temple Lang, a very, very senior legal figure who, you know, at that time had been in the legal service of the European Commission, was a director of DG4, as we called it then, DG Competition as it is now. And this issue came up in conversation with him, and I said, you know, first I was interpreting the AM&S case, particularly it's controversial because legal privilege does not extend to in-house lawyers. It only extends to lawyers in private practice. And I, you know, expressed a view in relation to it, and he kind of disagreed with me, and I was saying, well, I don't know if you're entirely right about that, John. And then he explained to me that he personally had argued the case in the court in Luxembourg. So I deferred. I said, okay, you probably know more about it than I do. Again, legal privilege, I'll just say a few words on that because this is one of the things that's driving this. He said, and I'm just reading from a commentary on it here, there's no legislative basis for legal privilege under EU law. The source of the doctrine of EU privilege is a 1982 judgment in the Court of Justice in the case of AM&S Europe v. Commission. The case and all subsequent cases on EU privilege have been in the field of competition law, probably because it is where the Commission has investigative powers and is permitted to apply sanctions directly. So what protections does EU privilege offer? It's clear the AM&S case and the AXO judgment 2010, the AXO Nobel case, which reinforce it. It's clear from, and this is commentary, it's clear from the AM&S and AXO judgments in the context of competition law investigations, materials exchanged with external EU counsel, one for the sole purpose of seeking legal advice, and two that are relevant to the client's right of defence, will benefit from privilege. And we can go into, I'm not going to waste time talking about what else it extends to, but this is important. In addition, EU Commission courts have taken the view that EU privilege extends only to advice given by external counsel or independent lawyers, but entitled to practice in one of the member states. And that is what they are interested in and concerned about. And I've spoken in London, at Law Society of England Wales, lawyers who are thinking of coming over, and to practitioners in Brussels who are. And these are guys who really know their way around all this, and they're very, very expert, specialist EU practitioners in Brussels. Where, as an aside, I'll mention that as people are seeking to maintain their status post-Brexit, Or as I jokingly say, will the European Commission return their calls after Brexit? One of the things they're trying to do to improve their status is to try and get EU nationality, any of them who are able to. Dead Irish grannies are being pressed into service. The head of, a good friend of mine, John Boyce, who's the head of the Slaughter and May office for many years in Brussels, told me proudly recently he is now a Belgian citizen. Michael Reynolds of Allen & Overy, head of the Allen & Overy office in Brussels for decades, told me recently he's now a Portuguese citizen. He and his partner have had property in Portugal, they got Portuguese citizenship. So people are doing what they can to improve their status. We've made clear, as Law Society of Ireland, that they take their own advice on this. We're not saying whether or not they continue to be entitled to have EU privilege in these kind of cases. That ultimately might be a matter that will appear that Gerard Hogan might be opining on at some time in the future if it's ever challenged. But clearly it helps to be on the roll in an EU member state afterwards. This is fairly important for practices of this kind. For Freshfields, for example, to give you a sense of the level at which they operate, Freshfields are acting for Apple against the EU. We're talking about very, very serious players in this space. And they are, so they're now on the roll in Ireland, and I say those numbers are changing every day. But one of the things, the question then arises is they're on the roll, but they don't have practicing certificate. The 2,000 or so that I've talked about there, the majority of them don't have practicing certificates, but about 250 of them do, which, as I said to the solicitors at the Southern Law Association in Cork last night, helps to subsidise their practicing certificate fee. But they have not arrived here. Who's actually arrived here? The only firm that's really established here and operational here at the moment in any sort of scale is Pinsent Masons. Now, again, we met with the senior partner, Pinsent, over in London before they arrived here. And they told us quite categorically, and they're repeating, they've said this publicly, that they had intended to establish in Dublin before Brexit, and they were doing it regardless of the Brexit vote. That's what they say. Obviously, and I know from my years in A&L Goodbody, we were always looking over our shoulders, frankly, the big London firms could have established offices here in Dublin at any time, really, for decades. There's no difficulty. Certainly, the Establishment Directive came into force. But even before that, they would have rights to establish up. They have chose not to do so. Actually, they were doing Irish law advice probably from London. They didn't actually need to be here. Maybe the market was considered too small. But in any case, they chose, for whatever reasons, not to do so. And they're maintaining that position, by and large. Pinsent Masons, who are not a big, they're a big international law firm, but they're not on the scale of some of the firms that are listed there. But they have, they're a very prestigious, very successful firm, and very dynamic and innovative firm, but they are here now. Also, if you look at, one of the things, if you look at those 20 firms, seven of those firms are actually US headquartered firms rather than UK headquartered firms. Latham & Watkins, Hogan Lovells, Baker & McKenzie, Chicago, DLA Piper. Now, DLA Piper are in a completely different scale from Pinsent Masons. DLA Piper are listed normally as the fourth largest law firm on the planet. And I was in Rome at the IBA recently, talking with the senior partner, global senior partner of DLA Piper. We talked a little bit about the legal services market in Dublin, on which I have to tell you, I was impressed by how well informed he was about the legal services market in Dublin. But DLA Piper are here. I think they've one or two people here, and it remains to be seen. There are rumors as to their acquisition of premises and so on. We'll have to wait and see how big DLA Piper intend to grow here. And of course, our next speaker, Marie, is from Covington & Burling, who I think are largely a Washington, D.C. based firm, and she may talk about that as well. But in terms of impact on legal practice here, the reality is, and the piece I wrote in the Law Society Gazette about this, is that the Brexit refugee solicitors, as I'm calling them, are enrolling but not arriving. They're not establishing firms here with rare exceptions. Now, Simmons & Simmons, I was at there in the Shelburne Hotel there the Thursday before last. They had an opening event, and they're largely funds-focused firm, I think. But so there is a shake-up. There's a disturbance in the force. You know, there are things happening here, but we don't know, and as I said earlier, everything in relation to Brexit, all you can say is to date. You don't really know what's going to happen long-term. I want to pick up on what Patrick Leonard was saying earlier, because we followed on the initiative, and he's played a key role in that initiative. We're lobbying government in relation to the opportunities that may exist for legal practice in Ireland. And of course, it's the usual stuff about, you know, we're English speaking and we're common law and, you know, we remain in the EU and all that. But I say it remains to be seen, is that really a game changer? It's in fact the fact that the UK will no longer be an EU member state. Is that actually a game changer for the point of view of the preeminence, the dominance in Europe of London as a centre for transaction and dispute resolution to a far greater extent than any other city or any other jurisdiction? There are lots of people out there nibbling away and trying to position themselves for that, and Ireland, quite rightly, is seeking to do so as well. I'm heavily involved in the International Bar Association, and I organised and chaired and spoke at a session in Oslo there in May of this year. And I'll just mention some of the names of the people. We had quite highly qualified speakers on this very subject, the implications for legal practice. Professor Hans-Jürgen Helbig of Hengeler Müller, very big Frankfurt-based firm, former president of the Deutsche Anwalt and president of the CCBE. We had Louis Bernard Bertrand, who is the president of the International Committee of the French National Bar. So people who know what they're talking about. Interestingly, and he said openly, he thought the notion that this thing which is being set up in Paris would attract business so that common law cases would be heard and determined in English in Paris. He was dismissive of it. Most people think it's fairly ludicrous. I think the likelihood of that actually taking off is remote. And it was interesting to hear somebody very well informed from the inside of the French National Bar express that view. But Ireland clearly should be positioning itself for this, for anything that may transpire. Any crumbs, frankly, from the London table would be very significant for the Irish legal system here, given the disparity in size. People put choice of law, choice of forum, clauses in international legal agreements for London, using English law on a choice of law basis for many reasons. But a lot of it is to do with the stature of the courts in London and the depth and the reputation they have for quality and for independence. How much of that changes as a result of Brexit? We'll have to wait and see. There may be issues to do with enforceability of judgments, but maybe not, and there's a lot of talk about this. One of the other speakers at this session in Oslo is a guy named James Palmer, who's the senior partner of Herbert Smith Freehills, who you'll see there listed seventh, actually, on that list. He confirmed again they have no plans to set up in Ireland, there is concern in London. You see it in the literature and the coverage. There's more stuff in The Lawyer this month about this, The Lawyer publication in London. There is a degree of apprehension there that things are being shaken up and that nobody knows where they'll fall. But there isn't, that I have detected from talking to a lot of them and reading the literature, reading the commentary on it, I don't detect this real worry about it. One of the things, finally, I might mention is that and this again is from the Lawyer, the weekly publication, daily as it is online now in London. The survey also quizzed lawyers. This is a survey of law firms in the UK and around Europe. Survey also quizzed lawyers about the short-term impact of Brexit on their teams. More positive news for the UK firms. Lawyers on both sides of the channel are experiencing a surge in Brexit-related work. 72% of European responses pointed to a pre-Brexit increase in workload. as did 46% of UK lawyers. It's mainly taking the form of advising clients on the regulatory implications of Brexit. For example, banking and finance lawyers in Frankfurt report they were helping clients shift operations to Germany. Swiss private client lawyers were talking about individuals move from London and to Switzerland and Monaco. And 61% of UK respondents were expecting to increase a rising demand for legal work and are recruiting accordingly. A final comment I'd make is whether or not any of these firms established here, other than the ones that have already arrived, the pattern is clearly established that what they are doing, Pinsent's and DLA and the firms arriving here are, and this is the pattern internationally now, and I've discussed it with people at the top of these firms, is the old days, decades past, when people used to send in lawyers from the headquarters to run operations in other countries. That doesn't really happen anymore. Solicitors working in these firms are Irish solicitors. They are our colleagues working, just as Marie Gallagher is here. So nobody knows where Brexit will end up, but certainly in terms to date, because I keep saying to date, of Paul Revere racing around predicting the British are coming, not much sign of it yet. Thank you.